What hotspot's got the hippest groove?
Cleveland.
Where all the real granddaddies move.
Cleveland.
Dig that sweet Cuyahoga glow.
It smells so good.
Cleveland.
What's up, baseball fans? Welcome to Put Me in Coach, a podcast about baseball. My name is Matt Coggins, and you'll be hearing from my co-host Carl Mizell soon. This week, we have the second half of our deep dive into the losingest losers of all time, the 1899 Cleveland Spiders. If you haven't heard part one, I recommend going back to our feed and checking that one out first. But hey, I'm not your boss. Just to recap, we had a few decent years of baseball in Cleveland before the Spiders' owner, a loser named Frank Robeson, bought the St. Louis baseball team and moved all his good players there. In Cleveland, the stadium is falling apart, spring training was a bust, and the team is full of drunks and out-of-shape weirdos. We left off just as the Spiders came to St. Louis to begin what would be the worst season in baseball history.
So the intro series to this season could not have gone worse, but provided a preview for the many woes to come for the Spiders. During the fifth inning of the first game, while the Perfectos debuted their new mascot, which was a live baby gray fox for some reason, winds caused the crowd to panic, believing there was a cyclone, and a stampede was narrowly avoided. One unruly fan started throwing seat cushions at people, including the groundskeeper. Everyone on the Perfectos had at least one hit, including Cy Young, while the Spiders managed just five. Cleveland also committed four errors.
Not there you bad. Go. Not bad. I want to touch on how easily spooked people were apparently at the end of the 19th century. Like,
yeah.
What is this?
A little wind. And they're like, oh my God, a cyclone.
we were just talking about, like, right now the extremely cold weather that we're experiencing here in Michigan that you've been through. Could you imagine if they had to go through, like, it's 4 below and the winds are gusting at 50 miles an hour? Like, if they thought that was a cyclone, what would they think this was?
Yeah. You also got to remember, these are people whose stadium just burned down like 5 years ago. So, like, it's like you have seen much worse.
You know, the wind burned down during a game.
During a game.
Who heard of such a thing?
So game two saw even more enthusiasm from the St. Louis faithful as over 16,000 came out and required the park to accommodate standing room in the outfield, stringing ropes along the deepest reaches and requiring special ground rules for any balls hit that deep. You may know this as a home run nowadays. St. Louis took an early lead and built it to 6-0 by the seventh, but Cleveland was able to rally 5 runs by the ninth. The nervous home crowd avoided embarrassment when the Perfectos barely escaped with a 6-5 win. Loss number 2 out of 134 for the Spiders.
Matt is actually going to go through all 134 games. This is going to be a very long episode.
Yeah. And loss number 3. Here we go. No, it's... with the conclusion of the series in the Lou, which is apparently a nickname for St. Louis, not as cool as Flavortown, Stanley Robeson was asked for comment by the press about the Spiders and what his intentions were for the coming season. Emphatically, he pledged that Cleveland would be built up to be as good a team as the one they made in St. Louis, not merely a farm team as some had correctly called it. He continued lying, claiming there would not be a single player transferred between the teams again, and that each man was as strong a ball player and not merely a reject. When asked what he was doing to strengthen the team, he gave no answer. That's Stanley for you. Good old Stan. The follower.
When asked what he's doing to improve the team, he stared blankly at the reporter long enough that it was uncomfortable, and the reporter just walked away and was like, okay, goodbye.
I guess that's my answer. So while the Spiders started the season with a road trip, their first homestand was imminent. The Cleveland press made note that nothing had been done to clean up the rough and an uninviting league park, even with the season already underway. Instead of repairing the decrepit grandstand, the Robesons were instead in a land dispute with a neighbor that involved building a giant fence to cover all of his windows. That's all they gave a shit about, I guess.
Yeah.
Most fans doubted any games would even be played in Cleveland, and for good reason. As of the start of April, the team hadn't so much released an official schedule.
Oh my God.
So they arrive in Louisville for the next leg of the Barnstorm, and some took note that several of the Spiders were quite overweight. Saka Alexis, one of the few forced to stay with Cleveland after the merge, was overburdened with alcoholism and could barely move in the outfield. Louisville, led by up-and-coming star Onis Wagner, beat the Spiders 11-2. It was the second of 49 contests where the Cleveland's opponent would put up 10 or more runs. For good measure, they did it again the next day, winning 11-4. Spiders losses 3-4. Now, miraculously, Cleveland won their first game on April 22nd, 6-5, in a contest the Cleveland press decided was one due more to an accident than good playing. But hey, they won a game.
They don't ask how, they ask how many.
That's right. And that answer is 20. It was game one of a doubleheader against Louisville, which was a close affair that featured a multitude of errors and a brawl on the base paths between Harry Lockhead and Louisville's player manager, Fred Clark. Louisville bounced right back when game two started just 15 minutes later, which apparently is a thing they did with doubleheaders back then, and they beat the Spiders 15-2. Still, Bill Hill started the game with 5 walks and an early dismissal. His reliever retired 1 batter before allowing 6 runs on 3 wild pitches, 3 walks, and numerous hits. Cross, with his pitching options exhausted, started asking for volunteers from the infield. Louisville laughed at them. Lockhead, the shortstop who just got ejected from the first game for fighting somebody, he pitched 3 scoreless innings. That was loss number 5. They leave their first 2 series with 1 win in 6 games, so get used to that pattern. Actually, if that math was right, then they would have won a lot more. So.
Yeah. No, that would have been better than what they did. And I think the reason that they only had 15 minutes between those two games was to not give them time to get drunker.
That's true. That's a good point. All right, you spend too much time. And these guys are drinking, so.
We better, come on, let's go. Let's get them on the field. Let's go.
So like I said, I'm not going to spend a ton of time going through every single Spiders win or loss because they were just so fucking many. But as I mentioned, Hetrick has a really good breakdown of those wins and losses in that book, Misfits. So if you want a true game diary, a breakdown of every single game, go for that. He gets into so much detail. It's excruciating, but also like really drives home how fucking miserable this season was. I am, however, going to go through some of the worst losses and those rare wins. And you know, this was a long season, so there were a lot. For starters, Cleveland finally hosted their first homestand as May began, drawing a monster crowd of almost 500. The Robesons, of course, had done very little to prepare League Park to host a baseball season, save for a fresh coat of paint on the outfield wall. All right. The field was still ruddy, the stands barely standing, and even the Spiders' home uniforms, hand-me-downs from the Perfectos, still had St. Louis visibly stitched in. Still, they played their hearts out in a doubleheader against Louisville, winning Game 1 5-4 and nearly taking Game 2 had it not been for a walk-off trot from Louisville's tortoise-like catcher Kittredge, who advanced from second base during a scuffle at home, apparently not even bothering to touch third, and the umpire was none the wiser, which led many to lament that even umpiring was going against the Spiders, which gives very, like, Lions prior to this season vibes.
Oh yeah. I'm sure somebody threw a flag and then picked it up on the Cleveland Spiders.
Yeah. The next day, Cleveland again split a doubleheader with Louisville and jumped the Pirates into 11th place. Hey!
Hey!
The Cleveland press lamented that the team couldn't play Louisville every day. Unfortunately, those good vibes couldn't continue forever, as the team would host and then visit the Chicago Orphans over 5 games, losing all of them and giving up 10-plus runs in most. Now, as I mentioned before, this was another pattern in Cleveland season. Usually the other team scored a shit ton of runs. The opposing team averaged 8 runs a game and scored 10 or more runs in about a third of the Spiders' contests. No Spiders starter had an ERA less than 5. What's your average ERA these days?
If you're around 3 is pretty good, 3.5 to 4. Okay, you know, it's the Universal DH. 5?
Remember, generally, too, they pitched the whole game if they could. So that's 5 over 9 innings straight.
Yeah, yeah. So, not great. Not still not great.
Great. During one of the blowouts against Chicago, the only entertaining thing the Spiders did, and this is a really funny part, I'd say, they had an incident involving Orphans batter Harry Wolverton, who was ducking from a wild pitch thrown by Spiders pitcher Jim Huey. The ball, however, hit the bat and was ruled a foul ball strike. While Wolverton turned to argue with the umpire, Huey threw again directly at the bat, which made contact and this time kept the ball in play, which was fielded, and Wolverton was thrown out. What an awesome sequence.
Quick, give me the ball. Tink.
I know it's not saying much, but May would be the best month for Spiders baseball in 1899. They won 5 games in a 10-game stretch, including their best margin of victory all year, a 10-4 demolition of the eventual third-place Phillies. They'd hold a 7-19 record in May and do something they would never do again, win 2 games in a row. The aforementioned 10-4 win against Philly and a nail-biter in Louisville, 4-3. That's right, 2 in a row.
2's a streak, baby!
However, rumors began to spread that the league would be contracting at the end of the season, and the primary targets were the B-squad teams like Baltimore and Cleveland. Something we've talked about before, contraction, expansion. Go check out our episode from last season about that. Basically, all signs are pointing to the league saying we got too many fucking teams. Clearly, there's so many teams that you've got 2 B-squads going on. We gotta fix this. But Cleveland kept soldiering on. And true to form, they righted the ship. Or maybe, should I say, they wronged the ship, because they lost 13 straight to start June, including a 16-10 loss in Boston, where so many Spiders were ejected that pitchers started playing the field. After that brutal series against Boston, outscored 38-16, Robeson announced that Lave Cross, the beleaguered player manager, was to be relieved of his duties because he was getting traded to St. Louis. Now, while the Perfectos needed a third baseman, and I'm sure Cross was delighted to join the better squad, he was, without a question, one of the best things to happen to those 89 or the 99 Spiders. He was a brilliant fielder, a solid bat, passionate manager, and he made it clear that he cared about the team, and he was determined to get on a path to winning. It was, unfortunately, Robeson that killed any kind of promise that Cross might have had for a better Cleveland team. With an 8-30 record and .236 average at the time of his trade, it should be clear that after Cross, it was all downhill from here. So second baseman Joe Quinn takes over the team, and he continues this New York road trip that they were in the middle of. It saw them lose a sweep against the Giants, where the cavernous Polo Grounds saw the smallest crowds ever assembled in New York sports history, which was an average of about 300 in a 30,000-seat stadium. And then COVID-era baseball notwithstanding. So generally speaking, Polo Grounds is one of the biggest stadiums to ever have been built, not just by capacity, but by space, by the size of the field, and only 300 people showed up to these fucking games.
Imagine if you went into a coma in like August of 2020 and then came to last year in August of 2023. And when you fell asleep and went into your coma, you were watching an Oakland A's game. And then you woke up in 2023 watching an Oakland A's game. Do you still think COVID is happening?
Yeah. Oh, no. It's still going on.
No. We'll catch you up. It's a lot. They're going to Vegas. It's terrible, but it's fine. COVID's more or less done. It's fine. It's not COVID.
Oh, but at least the A's are still sticking around, right?
Yeah.
No.
They're not leaving, are they? I already said the Vegas thing. It's too late.
So the league's impending contraction started to take a toll on the team, and Robeson knew there wasn't much of a reason to keep more than the bare minimum on the roster. So even solid pitchers like catcher Chief Zimmer and pitchers still Bill Hill, Kid Carsey, they get released by the end of June. Everyone left, played like complete shit. In a 10-1 loss versus the Pirates, who also sucked, the Spiders committed 7 errors, with 4 coming from Harry Lockhead alone. Crowds started to dwindle, and by the end of June, Cleveland was drawing just over 100 fans to their average home game. And to close that devastating June, Cleveland hosted the same New York teams that beat the shit out of them recently on the East Coast, who did the same in front of a handful of Clevelandites before the Spiders finished the month sharing a doubleheader with the Giants against their old friends in St. Louis. A split doubleheader where St. Louis played the Giants first and Cleveland second. Perfectos held first place by a few games just a month ago, but were now slipping into some pretty average baseball, drawing the ire of the home crowd that once adored their new and improved team. After dropping Game 1 to the Giants, St. Louis's hometown faithful actually started to root for the Spiders to take down their sister team. And believe it or not, they did, by that slight margin of 3-1. They beat the Perfectos. So Cleveland would take 2 out of 4 games against Boston as June turned to July in what would turn out to be the final games played at home. While it was all but a given that Cleveland wouldn't play in 1900, some were at least hopeful they'd still be around to play some home games in the second half of 1899. But unfortunately, the rest of the league wasn't very interested in playing in League Park, and most team owners were actively lobbying the league to force Cleveland to play out the season on the road. The Robesons were among them. Given that the team that draws about 140 attendees on average isn't really making a profit game to game. There is also the issue of the Sunday games, which is kind of why that split doubleheader happened between two different teams. Cleveland didn't play baseball games on Sundays, but they were still on the schedule put out by the league. So at least once a week, they had to take a road trip anyway, or play a makeup game to make up for those Sundays that weren't played. The league decided to grant this extremely major exception, and Cleveland was allowed to play out the season entirely on the road, which is just nuts. The Forest,
I can't even imagine.
Yeah, and we'll get into exactly how it takes a toll on the team, but like just think, like, if your owner just up and decided, like, hey, we're gonna close Yankee Stadium. The Yankees are gonna play the rest of the season on the road. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I go out of town for work, you know, once a month. I hate it. I could imagine if I just lived on the road.
Yeah, and especially too, remember, like, this is pre-cars, pre-airplanes. They're taking trains.
Yeah. They don't have podcasts. None. What are they supposed to do with their time?
Read a damn newspaper.
Their own thoughts? Fuck that.
Can't be great. They suck. Their thoughts are just, you suck. You suck at baseball, you piece of shit.
You sit on this train and think about how bad you are at the game you're going to play somewhere else. Not in Cleveland.
Well, they still had one final series in Cleveland, and the Forest City faithful decided to come out in droves for their crew of misfits one last time, assembling over 1,500 for the July 1st doubleheader against the Bean Eaters. While it wasn't a sellout by most metrics, the energetic crowd made it feel like there was a baseball renaissance afoot in Cleveland. And this series of games was really fun. In Game 1, the Spiders were quickly down 7-0, and it stayed that way going into the ninth before a moment of baseball magic occurred. Do you remember that protest game that the Athletics had this year where all the fans, it was the reverse boycott where they sold out the game and the game was awesome because the A's had this magic come from behind win. This kind of reminded me of that. It's 7-0. We're going into the ninth. Baseball magic. Dick Harley and Joe Quinn knocked in infield singles on misplays from the Boston crew. A forced out moved them up, and a single up the middle drove them home. And after an Aussie Shrek flyout, the Spiders faced a 2-out, 5-run deficit and answered with a single, single, walk, double, single, and a double to tie the game. A scoreless 10th was followed by a 2-run Boston top of the 11th, and Cleveland knocked 2 singles to force a pitching change to Ted Lewis, who was wild, and a passed ball scored a run. Needing just 2 more to win, with a walk, single, and a line drive double, they managed to win in walk-off fashion, 10-9. While they were few and far between, this was by far the most stunning and deserved win of the season. This is a quote from one Cleveland paper celebrating. It is no exaggeration to say that the club that was soon to be cast adrift to become the Barnstorming Band displayed more genuine ambition and pluck in Saturday's great game than any home game has exhibited in 10 or a dozen years. There were no snarling remarks about the left field bleacherites, no talk about getting down to the Holly for supper, no loafing, no grandstand bickering with the umpires. Instead, Quinn's men simply played ball. That's what people like. It may be observed in this connection that while the cast adrifts were thus making the champions look like canceled postage stamps, the ex-Clevelands were sassing the umpires, quarreling with the audience, and incidentally, getting a beautiful walloping at the hands of the rejuvenated Orioles down in St. Louis. Which I think is fun. But the Spiders lost game two 14-0, and they wouldn't win another game in nearly 3 weeks.
Oh.
So, let's see here. They were swept by Pittsburgh, and once again by the wretched Perfectos. Baltimore won 3 games in a row by a margin of 29-1 before Cleveland managed to squeak in a win 7-2. They lost again the next day 21-6.
Oh, shouldn't have gone for two on that touchdown there, boys.
Orioles owner Frank Patterson implored the league to drop the Spiders immediately and annex a minor league team, as he thought their one victory in that series was sort of a fluke, and if it were to ever occur again, it would drive Baltimore fans to drink.
Oh my god. The
schedule change was pretty much official, and the Spiders played 7 games straight in Washington, holding on for 2 narrow wins before another 4-game sweep at the hands of Baltimore. I know you were worried, but the folks in Baltimore were not driven to drink.
Yet.
The Spiders would take 2 from the also bad Washington Senators, but suffered more sweeps at the hand of the Orioles. Again, so again, drink watch, we're good. And their old favorite foes, the Louisville Colonels. We love beating them. Remember beginning of the season when we lamented we couldn't play them all the time? There was a heartbreaking 16-13 loss, which I find wild. They're still scoring runs. It's not that they aren't, like, in some of these games. They're just losing them. It's wild.
That has to be the worst part. Like, scoring 13 runs and losing.
Yeah.
Has to be one of the biggest kick in the teeth.
At this point, the team was run ragged by their makeshift and vagabond schedule. They finished July playing 8 doubleheaders in 16 days, a consequence of rain delays and shifted former home games. The only rest they had was on the train between cities. Players began to joke that the union would kick them out for so much unpaid overtime. Fans were growing to distrust not just the Robesons, but the league in all of baseball for even allowing such a farce. I guess there is the question of, like, just let them stop. Just stop, right? Like, what is the point?
Yeah, wave the white flag. Just, you know, call every time they show up on your schedule, call it a W. You might as well. It's probably going to happen anyway.
Yep.
Let these guys get some fucking rest and go home and see their families.
It's really just a question of, like, what were they trying to prove something? Was the league just like, well, we can't not play the games? I guess there's the matter of, like, you got to sell tickets, but again, they weren't, the Spiders aren't bringing people to the stands. You just mentioned how New York, they were completely empty, so I really don't get why they were allowed to keep going, but they did.
Exactly. And another point, I keep referencing, like, back in this day, there were In cities, especially major cities, there were dozens, scores potentially, of baseball teams, like in industrial leagues and in all sorts of things. So it wasn't like now where you might, like, I drive 90 minutes to go see a Tigers game because that's the only major league team near me. But back then,
yeah,
you'd be like, yeah, man, I don't want to go see the Tigers. Which of the 17 teams within a 3-mile radius do I want to go see? So they didn't need to be there.
Exactly. Well, while they started August with a couple of wins against the Phillies and Chicago, so began another long stretch of losses. And some of these were particularly brutal. There was an 18-8 flop against Boston, a 13-1 skid versus the Giants, and the worst loss they took all season, 20-2, dropped to Brooklyn. In this 11-game losing streak, they were outscored 114-34. It's clear at this point in the season that the pitching has always been gassed, like from exhibition play and spring training, but now the offense is really starting to struggle and the defense is starting to struggle. Like, these guys are just done with this season. They had just 4 wins in August, setting them up for the most awful stretch of games yet. And this is where they truly hit the record books. From August 25th to October 6th, the Spiders won 1 game. And that win came smack dab in the middle on September 16th, enshrining them in failure once again with a 24-game losing streak, which would be among the worst in baseball history. But more impressively, they are the only team to lose 40 out of 41 games. Like, had they not won that one game, who knows what could have happened. But, like, what was there to play for at this point? You know, they're vagabonds, they're misfits, they're terrible ball players. They're working for a squad that wasn't long for this world. It's just pointless. Fall in the Spiders clubhouse was like a circle in hell covered in dirt, grass, and pine tar.
And that's the best explanation. They are literally in a circle of Dante's hell, because why are they still there? Why haven't they left?
God is punishing them. They've done something to piss off the baseball gods. There's two bright spots, though, here at the end of the season. So while the Spiders lagged far behind the rest of the league in nearly every single statistic, they were the leaders when it came to one relatively rare feat. They were the only team to play all 154 games.
Of course. Of course, the worst team would be the one to get in the most games.
The other silver lining was that, in spite of Robeson's efforts to build a pennant winner from the corpse of the Cleveland crew, the Perfectos would finish 18 and a half games behind Brooklyn for a lowly fifth place, outdone even by Brooklyn's B squad in Baltimore. While good. Patsy Thibault led... Yeah, fuck them. Fuck you, Perfectos, which has got to be the... I've not said this yet in this podcast. That's got to be one of the dumbest names for a baseball team ever. Right behind the Super Boss, which I don't know what that means.
I was wondering. I was like, Super Boss, Superbas?
Superbas? Well,
either way, it's not great.
They're the Dodgers. They just weren't dodging the streetcars yet because they weren't invented yet. While Patsy Thibault led another squad to a winning season, and they did. They squeaked out a winning record, the St. Louis, but they went home that October with just as many rings as the Spiders did, so it wasn't really what the Robesons set out to do. Before the final games, a doubleheader against the Cincinnati Reds, Tommy Dowd, the outfielder, spoke on behalf of the misfit players and reflected on their season from hell. And this is a quote from Tommy. "At least 50 times the past season, we have got together at the hotel before going to the grounds and said, we'll win that game today or break our necks. And we would mean it too. But the other teams would jump up and start to skin us so bad that we'd come off the field with our heads hanging down and our good intentions all shattered. It's such a heartbreaking experience."
Yeah, we should have just broke our necks.
Yeah. You know what, guys? Just break them. Just break them right now. We can't do this.
I'm going to put my head down, just step on it. Step on my neck right here.
Appropriately, the Reds defeated the Spiders in their final game, 19-3. Cleveland, apparently out of all other options, started 19-year-old Eddie Kolb, who was not a professional baseball player, but literally just the guy that ran the cigar stand outside of the stadium. The Spiders actually never recorded a win against the Reds that season and were outscored 50-fold. When the season mercifully ended after 9 final innings, they packed up to Cleveland to collect nearly 6 weeks of back pay, still owed to them by the Robesons because, of course... At this point, they were openly threatening violence to their soon-to-be ex-employer if the checks weren't signed. Can you blame them?
No.
And when the dust settled, the players finally paid, the league had all but closed the casket on the Cleveland Spiders. The Forest City's paper of record, the Plain Dealer, summed up the 1899 campaign with one beautiful understatement. It has been a bad season for Cleveland fans.
And that's why the Plain Dealer is still around, folks.
That's right. That's hard-hitting journalism right there. So here's the aftermath, and I want to talk a little bit about Louisville. Connect this to what the syndicate league meant. A few months earlier, Louisville's ballpark burned down. Common thing back then, apparently. The team was already experiencing some of the worst financial woes in the league. This was yet another enormous burden, made even worse when an insurance settlement couldn't be reached, so new stands could not be constructed. Fans of the solidly average Colonels were expected to stand in late summer Kentucky heat for a team many theorized just wouldn't be around in 1900. They stayed home instead. That 1899 season saw baseball coming back into form after a wild 1890s that saw at times a war, 3 different professional leagues, labor disputes, evils of syndicate baseball. Yet still the sport was a business, and only a handful of teams were actually turning a profit. Owners of said teams, namely Chicago, Philadelphia, and Boston, were concerned with trimming the fat off of this bloated league of theirs. Not only was there a concern for the revenue sharing and the travel expenses, but with so many teams vying for just one pennant, it was overly crowded while lacking true competition. While this contraction conversation started around 1895, the performance of these syndicate teams like the Spiders and the indebted clubs like the Senators and Colonels made it clear to the league and team owners that action was necessary after the 1899 season. But what stands in their way? Capitalism, baby. Our intrepid capitalists would not go down without a fight, even though they just won their pennant, and apparently their owners had stake in the Giants, Reds, and Orphans, the owners of the Brooklyn Club insisted they would not shutter their syndicate group in Baltimore without a substantial payout. Washington went up for sale, but they still held on to all their player contracts. Louisville, despite only having half a burned-down shell of a stadium to play in and a mountain of debt, they insisted they would field the team in 1900 and promptly signed 10 men to the roster, announcing they would search for even more guys willing to play for $100 or less. Which, yeah, great. Professional baseball right there. Even the Robesons, the guys that threw in the towel on Cleveland 8 months earlier, insisted they would bring the Spiders back to the Diamond in 1900. In contrast, Boston's owner, Arthur Sodden, led the other owners in a steadfast refusal to give any sort of buyout. League president Nick Young, caught between a rock and a hard place, I guess, would continue to deny contraction was even being entertained. In the midst of all that chaos, Louisville's Barney Dreyfus bought the Pittsburgh Pirates and combined their rosters a la the syndicate style of ownership that we've become so familiar with today. Sodden saw this as a perfect opening to simply consolidate all the syndicate teams and buy out Washington. The teams in question instead refused to entertain any idea other than a buyout. There were whispers that a new league would be taking shape soon, and if the National League didn't want to field a team in Cleveland or Louisville, that was their loss because they could gladly take an offer from the next association. The NL is right back into that same predicament that we started the podcast with. We've got other leagues vying for your teams, and you're either going to buy them out or put them on the field. Rumor had it that Louisville and Cleveland wanted at least $20,000, while Baltimore and Washington wanted $60,000, meaning the rest of the league would need to pony up upwards of $150,000 or $5 million in 2023, which, compared to how much these guys spend these days, doesn't really seem like that much.
No.
The Little Four left in December meetings, insisting that outside of a buyout, they would be fielding a team. By March, renewed threats of counter-league taking shape and gaining ground with interested parties in St. Paul, Milwaukee, and Chicago, the National League finally bit the bullet, agreed on the buyout, only cost around $100,000 as opposed to $150,000, and they swiftly dissolved Cleveland, Baltimore, and Louisville. Washington held out hope to join the counter league, and so they retained all those player contracts, but they did not field the team in 1900. So, and here's where it gets a little interesting. There's a guy named Ben Johnson. He's an executive with a few puritanical bones to pick about the National League, which again is nuts because the National League was the puritanical league just 10 years ago. But I guess he was even more puritanical? I don't know. He took a minor tier league called the Western League and reorganized it in what would soon become the American League. Leveraging this contraction and his connection with former St. Louis manager Charles Kaminsky to start up new teams in Chicago, Detroit, Kansas City, Milwaukee, Minneapolis, and more, including Cleveland, which we will get back to in a minute. After a successful 1900 campaign, the American League was classified as a major league for professional baseball, and they added teams in Boston, Baltimore, and Washington, luring several players away from the NL because they had better pay, nicer stadiums, and way better attendance. Many of these inaugural American League teams are still around today. As far as the Robesons are concerned, St. Louis would never improve on their 84-67 1899 season under their ownership. Although they stayed competitive for a few years, the Robeson era team never improved past third place and largely started sucking once those players could jump ship to the American League. In 1900, inspired by a fan remarking the lovely shade of cardinal in the Perfectos uniforms, they changed their name to the Cardinals, which they still are today. Frank Robeson died in 1908. Ironically, as the Cardinals finished one of their worst seasons in franchise history, setting MLB records for low attendance and fewest walks. Frank probably wasn't concerned, as he seemed to have his heart tied to another resurgent team, the Cleveland Naps. It was reported that Frank suffered a cardiac arrest while listening to play-by-play of a Nats-Senators game, where Cleveland dramatically lost after dropping 5 runs to Washington in the 9th. The man who killed baseball in Cleveland, ironically, was killed by Cleveland baseball. Stanley, the aforementioned joiner, accompanied his brother to the grave 3 years later. The Cardinals were left to Frank's daughter, Helene Hathaway Britton, who became the first woman to ever own an MLB team.
I think we found Stanley's limit on where he'll follow his brother. He was like, I got a couple things I got to do before I go. I can't die just yet.
Oh, but he wanted to. He's like, well, shit. If he's not here, what am I supposed to do?
Who am I supposed to follow now? He just wandered the countryside for 3 years.
Fortunately, the death of the Spiders was not the end of baseball in Cleveland. A Western League team called, I shit you not, the Grand Rapids Furniture Makers was moved by Ben Johnson to Cleveland prior to the 1900 inaugural American League season, and the aptly named Blues, their uniforms were blue, were among the charter teams. The new owner was coal magnate Charles Summers, who also owned stake in the Boston Americans, but, crucially, instead of syndicate-style ownership, he spread his wealth around the American League in the interest of keeping the whole thing afloat. And he personally saved a lot of these historic teams like the Athletics. It wasn't just syndicate ownership. It wasn't just that he had, you know, dollars in every team. He was really trying to do this as a philanthropic effort. So, you know, good on him, honestly, because if he was another Robeson type, who knows where baseball would be right now. The Blues bled money nearly the entire time Summers owned the team, but managed an average to successful run throughout the aughts and into the teens, led by manager player Nap LaJoie, who also inspired the team's new name, the Cleveland Naps. Cy Young spent some of his final years of his career with the Naps, capping a stellar career with a few pretty okay seasons. The mid-teens weren't kind to Cleveland or their owner, because Summers lost nearly all of his money and was forced to sell the team, and LaJoie's bickering with management led him to a swift trade. Their record continued to sag. They did, however, adopt a new name, inspired by the old nickname granted to the Spiders back when Louis Sakalexis roamed the outfield. Cleveland officially changed their moniker to the Indians, later the Guardians, in 2022. Now, this Cleveland team...
I had no idea that's where that came from.
Yeah, they legitimately had one of the first Native American players on the team. And even back in the Spiders' days, they would get the... And you can read this in the book that I've cited a few times. The press will call them the Indians because they got one Native American guy on their team. And they're like, oh, well, all these Indians playing in Cleveland.
Wow, that was so racist, but also like... Like, you got one, so they're infested. Because one is too many to these people.
So this Cleveland team, now one of the oldest constant teams in the league, rose from the ashes of the Spiders' failure in 1900 and have become one of baseball's old standards, with 2 World Series wins and 6 AL pennants. Ownership these days is not without controversy. Retired attorney and Cleveland native Larry Dolan has owned the team since 2000. Dolan has been known for a miserly attitude towards the team, keeping player salaries amongst the lowest in the league, with varying degrees of success on the field. And you see this today. Cleveland is a very young team, a very underpaid team. If you look at guys like Jose Ramirez, severely underpaid for the amount of war that he brings to the team. But he wanted to play in Cleveland really bad, and they sort of have... Terry Francona kind of added to the mindset of this, but they have a very homegrown, cheaply paid team. And like I said, it pays off sometimes, it doesn't, but Dolan doesn't really care. I did want to take a huge distraction from our script because Larry Dolan has a nephew named James Dolan. Have you heard of James Dolan, Carl?
I am a huge fan of people shitting on James Dolan. So yes, I know who James Dolan is.
Perfect.
Please join in the parade of shitting on James Dolan.
For those that don't know, James, Larry's nephew, is the maniacal owner of Madison Square Garden Sports and Entertainment, which include the eponymous venue, sports teams like the New York Knicks and the Rangers, Radio City Music Hall, and that fucking awesome sphere that they have in Vegas, the big sphere venue. He owns that. This Dolan recently made headlines for using facial scanning technology in his venues, which include, by the way, the biggest arena and the biggest theater in New York City, and using that technology to ban lawyers and members of organizations who were suing him. He's being sued for this now, too. Also, another weird, fun James Dolan fact is that he has a terrible band called JD and the Straight Shot, which, due to who he is and the venues that he owns, has opened for the likes of Billy Joel, the Eagles, ZZ Top, and more. They were also featured on several movie soundtracks thanks to his producer friend, the one and only Harvey Weinstein.
Oh, God. Oh, man.
So it seems like no matter who you follow in sports, there's a crazy evil billionaire or his family member in charge of something.
He would be associated with Harvey fucking Weinstein. Oh, God, James Dolan is such a piece of shit. Anyway.
Yeah, so Cleveland, if you think you got it bad, at least it's not the nephew. The National League unofficially banned syndicate baseball after the 1899 season once the dust had settled and the multiple B-tier teams were shuttered. In 1910, both the National and American Leagues came together to officially ban any owner from controlling multiple MLB teams, which the U.S. government certainly wouldn't allow anyway. As you mentioned, there aren't really... There is that antitrust exemption, but you have to imagine that there would be some sort of competitive disadvantage that the government would step in on. I don't know. Maybe not. Now that I'm thinking about it, maybe it doesn't fit. But there are rule breakers regardless. And here's a couple of examples. The Athletics were purchased by a real estate mogul named Arnold Johnson in 1954, who moved the team from Philly to Kansas City. And initially, this was praised as an awesome move because it brought baseball to Kansas City for the first time. And it became clear that his primary goal with the A's was actually to serve as a farm system for the Yankees. For over a decade, nearly every good young player from the A's was traded to the Yankees for aging vets or cash. He also owned Yankee Stadium prior to 1953 and purchased the Yankees AAA team stadium, which was located in Kansas City. Just insider dealing left and right. This relationship only concluded with Johnson's death, and the league never punished either team for these shenanigans. There was also 2002, where, and I think we mentioned this on the podcast before when we talked about expansion, but there was that wild deer with the Expos, and the Marlins, and Bud Selig, who was the commissioner of baseball at the time. Basically, the Major League Baseball bought the Expos. The guy that owned the Marlins bought the Red Sox, and the guy that owned the Expos bought the Marlins. There was a whole fucking shenanigans, and then they ended up moving the Expos to D.C. And that was all because the guy that owned the Expos just wanted more money to build a stadium and didn't get it from the government, of course.
And there was a challenge to the Major League Baseball's antitrust exemption last year. Minor League Baseball sued. The case was settled, so the antitrust exemption is still in place, but it's probably, we'll see, not long for this world. But it did inspire one of my favorite baseball quotes of all time from Ted Turner back during collusion. He famously told all the other owners at a meeting, "We have the only legal monopoly in this country, and you are all fucking it up."
Good old Teddy Turner.
Yeah.
So as I said at the beginning of this saga, it is often erroneously overlooked that the Spiders weren't simply just a bad team. They were victims of greed, heartless businessmen, and good old-fashioned capitalism. And while they might be the most egregious example in the history of the sport, it should serve as a reminder that this type of greed still corrupts America's pastime to this day. Because just in this past year, we watched as the multi-billionaire owner of the Oakland A's decided, against the will of their fans and local residents, to up and move the team to Vegas because Oakland wouldn't pitch in to help him build a new stadium. And when the residents and lawmakers got angry that their team was leaving, he slashed the already pitiful payroll and traded away any and every star for pocket change. John Fisher might have destroyed the Athletics and single-handedly led them to one of the worst MLB seasons of this generation, but he's not the only greedy son of a bitch that owns a baseball team. Mid-market teams like the Pirates, Marlins, Reds, and Diamondbacks are all owned by multi-millionaires or billionaires who personally increase their wealth annually to the tune of 10 times their team payrolls, but rarely invest that into the on-field product. Teams like the Orioles and Rays have owners notorious for proudly keeping payroll low in spite of their talented core. At least we got the Rays getting that new stadium, thanks in part to the Florida taxpayers, of course. So, of course. As we mentioned at the top of the last episode, we've got the Ohtani-Yamamoto-Glasgow situation, all the more that are joining the LA Dodgers supergroup, and doing so with team-friendly contracts. It's led a lot of baseball fans to ask if such a conglomeration of power on one roster is good for the sport. And additionally, the Atlanta Braves have had some really interesting financial schemes going on with their extremely talented players. They're barely paying them, and they defer a ton of these payments and also donate a chunk of their salaries to their nonprofit. That's kind of weird. The Yankees, be it now or in the 90s, they have never shied away from spending a shit ton of money and collecting star players. Even the Mets, who they are owned by a literal corrupt financier, they spent so much that the league had to invent a new tax threshold to basically say if you spend over this amount, you gotta spend more in what is that? Profit sharing, or, you know,
it's the luxury tax. You have to you pay more the further over the threshold you go, the soft cap.
So it seems like we've very quickly approached a world where all the more talented players have kind of been consolidated to the same five teams while the rest of this league and their fans live in despair. Now, you know, we had that conversation. Is it good for the league or not? I think mm-hmm. it's good for the players to get paid. But I do think it sets up this have or have not system. Baseball has no salary cap, unlike most American pro sports, and I'm not saying it should. I think the players deserve to get paid. Teams deserve to be competitive. The difference is that not all teams are playing the same game. Some of these owners want a strong team on the field, and others want to own a team as cheaply as possible. After all, if it makes a profit, what does it matter how it performs? So you end up with a league shaped not so dissimilar to the one we had in 1899. All the best players on a select few teams, all the worst on a few unfortunate ones, and several more in the middle praying for some kind of miracle that might propel them to compete. Some teams operate how Frank Robeson ran the Perfectos, and others how he ran the Spiders. That disparity, a literal caste system of sports organizations, is a central issue plaguing baseball right now, as it did in 1899. And from a distance, we may laugh at the sad and futile effort the Cleveland Spiders endured in 1899. And make no mistake, losing that many games is legitimately funny as shit. It's a comedy of errors. How did they lose so many games? But under the surface, our country's obsession with the system of haves and have-nots is what put them there, and what continues to make our favorite sport suffer. In a sense, the Robeson business of ruthless baseball capitalism is the most American thing about our national pastime. And as a postscript, I'd just like to say, fuck Ohio. And that is my story about the Cleveland Spiders.
We are legally required, being from Michigan, to say that at the end of every episode.
Yes. I don't know, Carl, what do you think? We had a brief intro to that conversation earlier, but that was my general point. I don't think it's bad for the players. I don't think it's necessarily bad for the league. I want the Dodgers to do what they did. I just want 29 other teams to also go for it, and there's really no excuse for not doing that.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I want to say what a fantastic job you did on this. This was exceptional. So you should be very proud of the work you did. To answer your question, it's a nuanced conversation because, like you said, Chicago. What is Chicago doing? By all accounts, the Chicago Cubs have been in on like all of the major free agents. They were in on Ohtani. They were in on Yamamoto. They're still in on whomever is still out there, apparently. Teams are trying. And I mean, it's far more nuanced than we can get into at this point, but there are a variety of factors. If you don't already follow Trevor May, the now retired former relief pitcher, most recently with the Oakland Athletics, he said in a YouTube video recently that he intentionally, even though he knew Oakland was bad, he wanted to go to Oakland. Not because he just wanted to kind of not have attention on, like, he just wanted to go somewhere where there wasn't so much attention being paid to him and he can sort of work and develop and grow. Gary Matthews Jr. back in 2006, after he had that one really good season and parlayed it into a good contract, he could have either gone to San Francisco or the Angels. And he chose the Angels because his son, from a partner whom he was not with, lived in Los Angeles. So he could have gotten the same amount of money in both places, wanted to be closer to his kid. Trey Turner took less money in Philadelphia than he could have gotten in San Diego because his wife's family is from South Jersey, right across the river in Philadelphia. All of that is to say, teams, we will never fully know whether or not teams are quote-unquote trying. Teams do need to spend money on payroll, and there's more to it than that, because if it were just about payroll, we wouldn't have seen Arizona in the World Series last year. So it's an extremely complex issue, and I understand why a lot of fans feel like, why isn't my team throwing money at everybody? You don't know that they're not trying. We're not privy to all of these conversations. And then there are times where, like, maybe Scott Harris in Detroit called up, you know, Nez Cabello's, Shohei Ohtani's agent, was like, hey man, Detroit. And he might have laughed before he hung up the phone. You have to be realistic about your team. If your team is not in a place to win right now, or if they don't have anything else going on for them at all, you're not going to see those free agents. Look at San Francisco. People are trying to shit on the city of San Francisco like it's Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome out there. Yeah. It's a beautiful city. It's an expensive city. It's a large city that has its problems like everybody else. But even Buster Posey is out here trying to carry water saying, well, guys just don't want to play in San Francisco because they think it's a bad place and their wives don't want to live here. No, they don't want to play there because they don't think you're in a position to win right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why they don't want to play there. So, yes, I can see why a lot of people would think that way. But conversely, I just will never know truly unless it becomes like you have to tell everybody who you're talking to. You're not going to know. So will it change? Maybe. But I personally think everything is great right now because I think it's going to be hilarious when the fucking Brewers trounce the Dodgers in the NLCS. And then we're going to get an entire offseason of people bitching about how the Dodgers spent all this money and still can't win. And meanwhile, scrappy little Milwaukee is out there, you know, going to the World Series. And then somebody will complain that the playoffs are broken again because the best teams didn't win.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I even said at the beginning of the podcast, I think it's more about what your team is than your individual players.
Yes.
I think that when it comes to money, it's such a fickle thing. And I mean it more in a sense of, you know, I don't think it necessarily has to be biggest payroll. I think it's just biggest effort. And that doesn't necessarily mean chasing free agents or giving out lifetime contracts. I think it's just a matter of, like, is your owner really doing everything in his multimillionaire power to make your baseball team great? Or does he just own it, you know? And that is, I think, something that is becoming more and more apparent. Even when you got a team like the Rays, as I mentioned in the piece, it's like, the Rays pride themselves in spending as little as possible and miraculously making a good team. But it's not a secret. They have great scouting. They have amazing development. And they have a great location being in the middle of Florida where it's like great weather year-round, you know, kind of a central area for, you know, the Caribbean and Latin America. And so that all plays into what makes the Rays great. That has nothing to do with how much money they spend. And they'll probably be, they lost, what, 3-4 great players this offseason? They'll probably still be in the playoffs this year because they're the Rays.
Yep.
And fuck it. I think, like I said, it's just more a matter of, like, when you see teams run like our Cleveland Spiders, like our Oakland A's, I don't really know any other teams to point at other than to say it's just a matter of effort. And capitalism tends to muddy these waters in sport because it's like, I want my team to win. I want them to win so bad, and I don't care how much money it costs because fuck money. Money's not real. Capitalism's not real. But of course, I'm not considering things like how many people are buying tickets? How much are you charging for tickets? How much money is the box office or the, you know, the concessions bringing in? I don't give a shit about any of that, but an owner does. So that's the world we live in.
Yeah. To answer your question, I think the first two that popped into my head in terms of like owners that are still catching shit for that would be Bob Nutting in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the Angelos family in Baltimore. Baltimore is going to be a magnificent case study because coming off of the season they had last year and all the momentum they have in this year, going with the excellent farm system that they've built up being terrible for the last decade. I'm curious to see what's going to happen. But Bob Nutting in particular in Pittsburgh is probably the closest we're going to get to a John Fisher. He's just smart enough to keep his mouth shut and stay out of the public.
Yeah. Great name, though. Well, folks, that's going to do it for us here on our very first long form episode of this show. Really hope you liked it. Let us know what you thought in the comments. And next time we meet, Carl, you've got an incredibly thrilling story, not about a team, but a player.
Yes. How much do you want me to tease? Because I'll tell you whatever you want to know.
Just give me a little tease. Tell us who you're going to talk about and what made them special and what stuff you want to dig into.
Yeah. So when I first conceived this idea, Willie Hernandez was still with us. Unfortunately, Willie Hernandez is no longer with us, and it is 40 years after his amazing 1984 season. So what I wanted to do was take a look at the season that he had in 1984, where he won the American League MVP, the American League Cy Young Award, and he was a member of a World Series winning team, making him only the third player in Major League history to pull off that feat. And I think that what he did that year, his stat line, could potentially be the future of pitching in Major League Baseball.
Oh, I love that. That's great. Yours shows promise, mine shows despair. And that's baseball for you.
You can't have one without the other.
That's great though, man. I definitely feel, even after this, you know, long recording session, I'm like, man, I'm excited for baseball again. Let's go. Let's start reading some fine reports and scouting stuff.
I am. I have been sitting here playing, and I subscribe to the Stathead. I pay to be able to access the Stathead database and do all the fun stuff. I have got a lot of stuff planned, but let's put it this way. I wanted to see if anybody else had a season like Willie Hernandez. No one in the history of Major League Baseball has had a season like Willie Hernandez. And we'll talk about that in 3 weeks, because this is the second of a two-part episode that we recorded in one night. So you'll see
but
it in the show.
It's actually next week when they listen to it, though. So.
Oh, that's right. I forgot. Yeah. So, yeah. So 3 weeks from today, or 1 week from this, you'll get it when you get there.
Time travel's fun. But hey, thanks so much for joining us. Please subscribe, tell your friends, share the podcast, give us a review, and cheer for your team. Let's go baseball. Let's go podcast. Goodbye.
Put Me in Coach is an Arctic Sounds original podcast hosted by Matt Coggins and Carl Mizell. Theme music is by Quack Quack Seatback. Edited and produced by Matt Coggins. Check out the footnotes of this episode to see links to all the great highlights, articles, and sources we mentioned on the podcast today, as well as the full theme song and ways to get in touch with us. For more, find us on Twitter and Instagram at PutMeInPod or at our website, PutMeInCoachPod.com.